Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
For your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting today from Chicago, from WCPT, our Chicago affiliate. And as always, the first hour of our program, and by the way, happy Friday, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, Juma Mubarak is how the Muslims say it, and whatever else it may be, whatever else your particular TGIF may be, greetings. As always, our first hour on Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent, neither a Republican nor a Democrat, the independent senator from Vermont, been on our program for years every Friday and taking your calls after Bernie and I have a chance to have a quick conversation. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. I'm not there right now. I hope to get there during one of the breaks in the next half hour or so. Working out some stuff with my computer right now. But I will be in there. And, of course, AirAmerica.com as well for more information. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And let me mention your website, sanders.senate.gov. It's one of the very best of all the senatorial websites. You've got a newsletter. You've got a pile of information there. You actually keep it up to date. It's a resource. It's an actual resource.
Well, I'll tell you something, Tom. And one of the issues I'd like to chat with you briefly about deals with that website, and that is just a few days ago, we sent out an email to people around the state of Vermont, and we said, listen, tell us how these outrageously high gas and oil prices are impacting your lives. And once again, I expected a relatively small number of responses. To the best of my knowledge, we're now over 800 people responding, which is a huge number for a small state. And also, in Vermont, people are fairly reticent about talking about their lives. But I think what is not widely understood is that with the middle class shrinking and people in so much trouble, what these gas and oil prices have done in many ways, Tom, is just take people over the edge, you know. They were just hanging on by their fingernails, and suddenly they're paying $3.75 for a gallon of gas. They're paying $4 to heat their homes. And you know what? That's taken them over the edge. And some of the stories that we're getting just kind of blow your socks off. They really talk about the transformation of America from a major world power, a country with a high standard of living, to a country in rapid decline in terms of our.
We're becoming a third world nation. And in fact,
some respects, well, when you read these things, you really hear it.
Yeah. And in fact, driving over to WCPT here, I got to tell you, Bernie, just a block away, there's a gas station. Dean, our engineer, is here. Dean, how much was that? It was like $4.25 or $4.26. It's well over $4 here in Chicago.
And, you know, I live in a rural state, and most of our people live in towns of 1,000 people or less, and they travel long distances to work. And when you talk about, when you combine the fact that, by and large, people's wages are not going anyplace, the cost of health care is going up. If you want to send your kids to college, it's an expensive proposition. Then you hit with this stuff. It's really terrible. And you see how it impacts. Let me just read you. Let me just thought of, I mean, I hadn't thought about this. You probably haven't thought. Let me give you one example of what high gas prices are due. This comes from a woman who works at the largest hospital in the state of Vermont, right here in Burlington. This is what she says. My story involves my capacity as an oncology social worker working with cancer patients in an outpatient clinic. I also run an emergency fund through the Cancer Patient Support Program, which provides funds to cancer patients in need during their cancer journey, including initial diagnosis, surgery, and treatment period, in which they experience a significant decrease in income during a medical leave. In other words, what she goes on to tell you is that in a rural area, if people are diagnosed with cancer and they need radiation treatment, you know what? It takes a lot of money for them now to get that treatment. They don't have that money.
Mm-hmm. They're in big trouble.
Yeah. So who would have thought, you know, normally you wouldn't think of it. This is a healthcare issue. People can't afford to get their radiation treatment. People can't afford to get to the doctor in a rural area. We got letter after letter, people literally in a situation where last winter, and if we don't make some bold changes, it'll be worse next winter, people's kids are getting sick because they can't adequately heat their homes. We're talking about old people who make the decision whether it is prescription drugs or whether it is food or whether it is keeping warm. This is the United States of America in the year 2008. And while we're talking about this, we're spending $12 billion a month on the war in Iraq. We have Republicans coming to the floor of the Senate telling us that we should repeal the estate tax so that we can give $1 trillion more in tax breaks to the wealthiest 0.3%. We have spending $515 billion every single year on the military, excluding the war in Iraq, including a massive amount of waste and fraud that's taking place in that institution. So all of this, what all of this speaks to is not only the need to transform our energy system, to break our dependence on foreign fuel and fossil fuel in general, but it also speaks to the absolute need to change our national priorities. The middle class ain't going to be there unless we act boldly. Poverty is increasing. People are in a lot of trouble, and the wealthiest people in the midst of all this make out like bandits. This is a fellow named Ray Emani. Does that mean Irani? I'm sorry, Ray Irani. Does that mean anything to you?
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, he's the head of Occidental Oil. You want to?
Oh yeah. I know who you're talking about now, yeah.
You want to take a guess what he made last year?
Oh, man.
Almost as much as you, Tom.
Yeah, right.
He made $400
million. $400 million in 1 year?
Yeah.
And that's one of the, that's not the biggest oil company in the world. This is one of the smaller ones.
Yeah. And you know, the oil companies are making great profits. So let me just briefly, because I know this issue is on many people's minds, certainly in the state of Vermont, and I think all over the country. What the Senate did and the House did, and it will get passed despite Bush's disapproval. And what you're seeing, by the way, from a political sense, it's almost funny. Is Republicans are now, you know, running away from Bush like a rat on a sinking ship. Bush says something and no one pays any attention to him. He did not like this, what we call strategic petroleum reserve proposal, which is a very modest proposal, which says that we should not be putting 70,000 barrels a day into the SPRO, into strategic petroleum reserve, when it's 97% full. Keep right. that on the market. It'll have some impact on prices. Bush the first did it. Clinton did it. Had some impact. That will pass. So we think that's a good sign. The real issue, I think, is two other important points. We've got to take a very hard look at speculation that takes place from financial institutions in driving oil futures up. There is a lot of evidence. I just talked to a guy yesterday who knows something about it. He thinks that, in fact, the price of oil is probably double what it should be in terms of the real cost of production and the distribution. That speculation is just having a huge impact on the price of oil. Yeah. Yesterday in the ag bill, there was a provision in a very big comprehensive bill that dealt with the so-called Enron loophole, which will bring more transparency.
Hmm. They're going to undo that, what is it, 97 or 96?
2000, I think.
2000, okay, yeah, great.
And that will have some impact, but we've got to go further. I mean, it's one thing to be critical of the oil industry for their greed, which they are, but on the other hand, it costs a certain amount of money to produce oil. That's true.
Yeah.
But you have people sitting around in the dark with no transparency, artificially driving up the price of oil, and that we have got to deal with. And the third, there are other areas that we have got to deal with as well, but I think short term, we need to fight as hard as we can to bring relief to working families who are really being hit over the head. Some good news in the Appropriations Committee yesterday, $1 billion more was added for the LIHEAP program, which is the federal program that provides heating assistance to lower and moderate income people.
Right. Which needs a new name, by the way, Bernie.
I know, you're absolutely right. It's called Low Income Heating Assistance Program, but we can do better than that. But anyhow, there's some, I've been working hard on that.
Save Working Families Act. You know, I mean, let's call it something like that.
There you go. So that's some of the other thing I wanted to mention to Tom. Actually, I was presiding last night when this happened. There was the passage of a motion of disapproval for the FCC's decision to further deregulate media.
Mm-hmm.
And as I know that many listeners have heard both you and I talking about, one of the great problems facing our country is the concentration of ownership in media.
Right.
We have a small number of large multinational media corporations to a very significant degree controlling what the American people see, hear, and read. And obviously Bush's people want to make a bad situation much worse by allowing newspaper owners to purchase television stations in large markets, right, which would just allow for even greater concentration.
Yeah, it's the Rupert Murdoch welfare program.
Among others, that's correct.
Yeah. It's Senator Bernie Sanders with us, our Brunch with Bernie Hour. His website, sanders.senate.gov, ours, tomhartman.com. And however you spell it, we'll get you there. 866-303-2270, the telephone number to call and speak with Senator Sanders right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from WCPT, where tonight in Darien, in suburban Chicago, at Frugal Muse Books at 7 o'clock, I'll be doing a short talk and signing books. And then tomorrow at the Green Festival, I'll be doing an hour talk from the main stage, one of the main keynoters, and signing books there as well afterwards. And I'm assuming WCPT will have a booth, and we'll hang out there for a little bit as well. So tomorrow will be a long and interesting day, and today as well, and we're having a great time. The folks in the chat room are, you're in Chicago, how can you be in Chicago and not be able to eat pizza because you can't eat gluten? And I'm finding gluten-free pizzas all over the place, so we'll check it out. Anyhow, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, sanders.senate.gov, his website, and calls for Bernie. Bernie, before we get to the calls, there's something I just wanted to clean up, I guess, from last week. You and I talked a little bit off the air. We really didn't get into it on the air. I tried to talk about it afterwards, and I thought, really, you said it so much better. If you don't mind, Hillary Clinton suggested this gas, a suspension of the of the tax on gas. And there have been a number of other strategies to try to reduce gas taxes over the short term. And they've been dismissed by I dismissed them. I mean, they've been dismissed by many folks as kind of gimmicks. And your warning, and after you told me this, I thought, you know, he's right. Your warning was that we're making the perfect the enemy of the good.
Well, that's right, Tom, in this sense. Look, virtually everybody understands that we need to fundamentally transform our energy system away from fossil fuel and foreign oil into energy efficiency. And we have huge potential to do that and sustainable energy. Concentrated solar power, for example, of which we're beginning to make some progress in the Southwest, can provide a very significant part of the electricity our country needs. You and I know the potential for electric cars, for plug-in hybrids, for a mass transportation system. We have got to go full bent ahead in all of those areas. But to ignore the reality that in rural America and all over this country, working people are taking money out of their food budget, out of their health care budget, to pay $3.75 for a gallon of gas, and to say, well, any proposal that tries to lower the price of gas, well, that's just a gimmick. That's not true. What I believe is that we need a windfall profits tax on the oil companies, and you use that money to help people pay for the gas they need to get to work, to get to the doctor's office. One way, and we've been really strategizing, how do you do that? If you bring in many billions of dollars through a windfall profits tax, how do you get that to the guy who has to fill up his gas tank? A holiday both on state and federal taxes coming from the windfall profits tax is one way to do it. I don't think people should be so quick to dismiss that.
Yeah, and you really got me thinking on that. And using it for partisan purposes, using it in a campaign, that's arguably a whole other thing. But let's realize people are hurting out there.
That's right. And, you know, then McCain comes along and says, "Well, we're gonna have a holiday." Well, where's that money coming from?
We're going to borrow it from our children.
No, in this case, he's going to borrow it. The money on the gas tax, federal and state, goes to the transportation funds, which builds our infrastructure. Everybody knows that our infrastructure is crumbling. So it is totally irresponsible to just take that money out of that fund. But if you get a windfall profits tax on the oil company, you're not taking money out of our infrastructure, but you are helping folks fill up their gas tank.
Right. So let's let our listeners get in on this. 866-303-2270, our telephone number for Senator Bernie Sanders this entire hour. David in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, listening on WINS. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
I'm in a catch-22. Because of my government policy, I am plunged into poverty for the rest of my life. I'm an independent trucker in Florida, right?
Yep.
Where construction has declined 70%. I've been living on my credit cards and borrowing money from my family to pay my mortgages. I am on the verge of filing bankruptcy. My credit has ruined because of the escalating fuel prices. I am working presently for the past 20 years, 80 hours a week, and I cannot survive in this country, supposed to be the most richest and powerful country in the world. And anytime I have lost my truck, lost my house, I'm on the verge of losing my family. And whenever I try to apply for a job, the company pulls up my credit and says,
yep.
You know what, you have bad credit, we cannot employ
yep.
you.
Yep.
So we need to change the bankruptcy bill and the whole thing right across the board.
There's this one fellow who says it all. I mean,
yeah.
And again, I urge people to go to my website. It's just what David just said, it touches on so many things. Nothing is isolated from anything else. Here's a guy who's a trucker. Well, you know what? Truckers can't afford to fill up their gas tanks because these
Chris, I just lost Bernie.
Totally off the wall, right? So here's a guy who's going out of business. Well, what does he do? He borrows money. He can't, you know, he's going into debt. So now he has credit problems. And I have heard this from many, many people.
Thank
this
you.
Gets back to the bankruptcy bill that I certainly voted against a few years ago. And you know, then somebody like David, if he gets sick, is going to have a hard time going to the doctor. And then he's going to get sicker, and then he goes to the hospital, and it's going to cost the system a whole lot of money because he couldn't get into the doctor in the first place, right?
Well, isn't there some kind of change to the bankruptcy bill as
yes.
a starting point that,
yes.
that should be, I mean, that this was a disaster to begin with?
No, you're absolutely right, and there are a number of us who are trying to do that.
Yeah, because, I mean, historically in America, we've said we want people to take chances. We want them to be entrepreneurs. We want them to go out and be independent truckers, and we're going to give them a social safety
net. But
here's
a guy who, through no fault of his own, is now going to have bad credit, which impacts his future economic future.
Yeah, it's a disaster. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Well, crazy, maybe it's no big deal. It's just my opinion, it's just how I feel. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
Oh, wouldn't that be exciting? Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program here on Air America Radio. We're broadcasting live from Chicago today from WCPT. And it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with Sanders.Senate.gov. And Tina in Brattleboro, Vermont, listening on WKVT. You're on the air with your Senator, Bernie Sanders.
Hello. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I had a couple of thoughts, and I'd like to just put that out there and see what Senator Sanders has to say, who, by the way, I'm in full support of, voted for you, went to one of the debates at the Austin School. It was great. It was a great experience for me.
Thank you, Tina.
And I would love to hear what your comment might be, if it's even worth your time, to comment on what our bully in charge had to say over in the Knesset. And then also I would like to see what you feel or think about how close we might be in our political arena in the United States to have a consensus on creating such a change of where we could actually take over the oil distribution and take it out of the hands of the businessmen who have proven themselves unworthy, because I think that government is designed to oversee business practices. It's not designed to be in control of, but it is designed to protect people from those that don't have a conscience, who do hoard wealth, and who, and because of that, create a lot of this other fallout, which is widespread now, poverty and disease and violence, and we all know why the Middle East is in an uproar, because
I think we've got it, Tina. Nationalizing oil, and what are your thoughts on the Knesset?
Well,
Tina, thank you very much for the call.
And the first part of that question, Tom, was Bush's remarks before the Knesset in Israel?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
What can you say about the George W. Bush that hasn't been said? He will go down in history, certainly, as one of the worst presidents in our nation's history, if not the worst. As I mentioned earlier, what you're even seeing right now, he is so unpopular, and that Republicans in the droves are running away from him, and I suspect most of McCain's campaign will be to say, hey, just because I voted with Bush for 7.5 years, I'm not Bush, and I'm different from Bush on this, that, and the other thing. That will be the whole thrust of his campaign. I mean, it was particularly embarrassing that he would make this remark in Israel, outside of the United States. One doesn't usually attack one's political opponents in other countries. And to compare the desire to try to stabilize the situation in the Middle East to suggest that people who want to talk to Iran are equivalent to those people who laid the groundwork for the Holocaust is just beyond comprehension. But that is what we have come to expect from the Bush administration. I should say that the Republicans of McCain don't have a whole lot to be saying. And generally speaking, I think in the next many months until the election, their major thrust will be that anyone who has a view different than Bush on the war or other issues, foreign policy, are going to be soft on terrorism. And that's basically what Bush was saying yesterday, that we don't know that that Osama bin Laden is a very dangerous guy, and the only way to deal with it is continue the war in Iraq and threaten Iran and so forth. And the other thing that they'll be talking about is that any of us who are concerned about low and moderate income people who want to ask the wealthy to start paying their fair share of taxes, we're just tax and spend guys and blah, 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 and they'll be distorting what our views are, and then gay marriage, et cetera, will be the third part. Not a whole lot more is going to come out of them, because these guys are intellectually bankrupt, and that's about all that they can say. So Bush will be working with McCain on that theme, and I think McCain came up with something similar yesterday. In terms of, you know, taking over the oil companies, that's certainly not where the political leadership of this country is today. I think at the very least, though, what we have got to do is to begin regulating these guys, and as I mentioned earlier, dealing with the speculation that is now taking place by hedge funds and financial institutions, which is driving up oil prices while the financial, while Wall Street makes huge amounts of money. That's an issue that has got to be dealt with. And I think that there should be a windfall profits tax on the oil companies and use that to lower the price of gas and oil right now. If we can move in that direction at this moment, I would be very, very happy.
Yeah, indeed. 866-303-2270, Tim in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WTKG. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I want to know why soldiers and military that were deployed in Iraq in 2007 aren't eligible for the economic stimulus checks because they didn't pay any taxes. Aren't other people getting them that didn't pay in any taxes? Thank you.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. What we have managed to do in the Senate is expand what came out of the House and what Bush wanted to include some 20 million senior citizens who were on Social Security and I think 250,000 disabled veterans, and that's where we are right now. What I did want to say, though, to the caller, to Tim, is pay attention, Tim, to what's going to be happening in the House and the Senate in the next couple of weeks, because I expect there will be the passage of the most significant improvement in a GI Bill of Rights program that we have seen since World War II. Senator Jim Webb of Virginia proposed the idea, and I was an original co-sponsor being on the Veterans Committee. And this is a program that would replicate what we gave to the World War II soldiers after that war.
I understand, Bernie, there's only 57 votes in the Senate, and McCain has not signed on with this, and the Republicans are going to filibuster it?
Well, we will see.
We'll see.
If I were a Republican, you know what? I'm not quite so sure I would want to be on the opposition end of this.
Yeah.
As Tim indicated, our soldiers in this war through death, through wounding, through post-traumatic stress disorder, through losing their homes, losing their jobs when in the National Guard they're called to serve. This is a generation of soldiers that has been hit pretty hard. And I think most of the Americans believe that at the very least what we can do is give them an education opportunity, the opportunity to go to college, to become part of the middle class. Than if there are Republicans who think it's more important to give tax breaks to billionaires rather than help veterans get the education they need, let them vote that way. But you know what? I think at the end of the day, I think we're going to win this.
Yeah, I sure hope you're right. Dave in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Dave, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. I had a question. Are there three or four Senate races that we should be watching and helping with in order to try to alleviate the filibuster problem?
We pointed out, by the way, Bernie, yesterday we had Colonel Noriega on, who is taking on Senator John Cornyn down in Texas. It looks like that's going to be a tight race.
Yeah, what's happening, I mean, I'm not much into political punditry. It's not my area of expertise. But the general feeling right now is, it was shown just last week in that House race in Mississippi for Roger Wicker's seat, where a seat in Mississippi, which has been in the Republican column for a very, very long time, was won by a Democrat. And the Republicans are going a little bit nuts now because they see the floor just opening up in front of them. They don't know what to expect. So generally speaking, what most people think is the Democrats will gain 5, 6, 7 more seats in the Senate. They'll gain a number of seats in the House. Whether or not it, to make the magic 60, will mean getting a what do they call it, a draw the straight or the straight or the flush or whatever it is. You'll have to be very, very lucky and so forth. But there are a number of seats out there where in North Carolina, for example, Elizabeth Dole is in much more trouble than people thought. In Texas, apparently, it's a long shot chance. In Maine, Tom Allen has a good chance to win. Al Franken, who obviously many of the listeners know, who used to be the host of the show.
Good guy. An absolutely
brilliant
good guy.
Yeah. Is running in Minnesota, and Al is in a tough race, but I think there are a lot of people think that Al could win it.
Right, and people all around the country should go to his website. I think it's Al Franken. It's either .com or .org, but you can easily find it. And, you know, kick him $25, $50, whatever.
That's
you
right.
Pay for.
And Al would be a very smart guy, and Al would be a huge asset in the Senate. So I think there are websites out there will tell you which seats are in play, but the answer is yes. The Democrats have a chance to make it to 60, probably more likely to 57, 58, and if you get that far, you will pick up a number of Republicans on key votes. So people should pay attention and help out the candidates that they support.
Amen. John in Texas, we have just a minute before we got to take a break here. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
John.
Senator, I just have a quick question about hemp and why we're not using it for fuel. I read an article in Esquire magazine 30 years ago that they were talking about hemp and its benefits to our economy, and I'm just curious why it's such a taboo subject.
Yeah, they're growing it like crazy in Canada.
I think you raise a good point, John, and I know in Vermont there has been a lot of discussion about it. Obviously, you know, the concern is its connection with marijuana and so forth. But hemp has been traditionally a very, very important product in this country from Revolutionary War days.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. It's certainly an area that we might want to explore for economic purposes.
Yeah. It seems that the production of biodiesel from hemp, it's so much more efficient than corn. I mean, it's such a more efficient converter of sunlight mm-hmm. into both the oils and into cellulose. It's just the only thing it'll do is it'll make it harder for the feds to fly over in a helicopter and identify what's pot and what's hemp. So maybe, which brings up the whole issue of revisiting the war on drugs, but that's a whole other issue.
Yeah.
We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders.senate.gov is website. Our number 866-303-2270. TomHartmann.com for our blog. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartmann Program.
3.5 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders with us this hour. Our Brunch with Bernie Friday, the first hour of our Friday program for low these many years. And ongoing, taking your calls. Bernie, we're so appreciative that you're always here with us and you're always taking calls from our listeners. Let's see here. Michael in Portland, Oregon. Michael, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator. Thank you. I really appreciate you doing this. I hear on the news that a lot of this oil price problem is caused by the speculators, and it seems to me that they would be a target that we should go after by artificially raising the price. Can you tell me anything about
that? Absolutely, Michael. We discussed it at the earlier part of this program. You're absolutely right. The good news is that just yesterday in the ag bill, there was language to repeal the Enron loophole, which will begin to give us some insight as to what these speculators are doing. But as I mentioned earlier in the show, there are some people. It's a cloudy area, and the answer is nobody knows all that much about it, precisely because these speculators and financial institutions are working in the dark with no transparency whatsoever. But what some people believe is that, in fact, the price of oil is double what it should be today, because of the speculation involved in these people bidding up oil futures. So this is exactly an issue that must be pursued. We've made apparently some progress yesterday, but we have to go much, much further on this.
Casey in Florida, listening on WINS. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Hey, Casey.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Sanders, this is Casey. I have a question for you.
Okay.
What I am concerned about is the Bush administration, the Republican Party, they are always talking about drilling in Anwar, drilling off the coast of Florida, and all these certain places, and the Democratic Party is generally against this due to pollution and things like that. What would the Democratic Party and independents think about creating a nationalized oil company to drill in Alaska, drill off the coast of Florida? It would create good middle-class jobs, take 100% of the profits, and put it into subsidizing green energy resources like solar, wind, and things of that nature.
Well, let me tell you what I think. For a start, according to the Energy Information Administration, that's Bush's own people, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would only reduce gasoline prices by a penny per gallon, and only in 20 years when drilling is at or near peak production. So I think the idea that drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and despoiling one of the important natural areas in the United States for a penny a gallon in 20 years, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But what Casey is saying, the principle of what Casey is saying, is putting more money into sustainable energy makes enormous sense to me. Tom, right now as we speak, or probably a few hours ago, there was a staff hearing in the Senate on solar thermal power. And I want listeners to know that right now there are plants being designed that will be built within the next few years, we hope and expect, which will use solar energy to provide electricity for millions and millions of homes. Pacific Gas and Electric, we hope and expect, will be breaking ground in a year or two for a 500-megawatt facility, which will provide electricity for 400,000 homes. There is the potential in Nevada, Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, to build dozens of these plants, which could provide a significant amount of electricity, significant percentage of the electricity we consume, with no greenhouse gas emissions and at an affordable or at least competitive rate. So that is the direction that we should go. Now, to pay for that, it seems to me, getting back to Casey's point, that we want to do away with the tax breaks and subsidies that we have given to the large oil companies and fossil fuel companies. And that is, in my view, the direction that we can go and has enormous potential and, by the way, creates good-paying jobs.
Sounds like a plan to me. Nancy in Paradise Valley, listening in Arizona, listening at KPHX. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders, Nancy.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Senator Sanders, I want to continue on the theme of oil and gasoline and the prices. We know approximately 40% of prices are pure speculation. We also know that OPEC nations make profits in the neighborhood of 200 to 300%. We've all talked about the dropping the 18 cents federal gas tax. We've talked about more drilling. We've talked on and on and on. And one thing that is not talked about at all is price controls on gasoline. And before you dismiss it, let me just briefly say, I'll pick a number and say $2.50 and make that a set price for that, for both unleaded fuel and for diesel, and put it in place for 1 year. That way, no matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican, when you go to the pump, you know you're going to pay a set price, because we also know that price of foods, goods, and services are skyrocketing because of continued increases in this crazy world of oil. There is no other way that you are going to get gas prices down unless the government controls the price, even temporarily.
Nancy, we're down
really
to, we've got about 30 seconds here before we have to wrap up the hour.
You're throwing out an interesting idea. And it's, you know, what economists would tell you is that it would have all kinds of side effects and ripple effects that we haven't contemplated.
Yeah, Nixon tried it produced shortages.
Right. But I think we need to come up, and I'm not being dismissive of the idea, but I think we need to come up with dramatic program which, in fact, substantially lowers and controls the price of oil. And thank you for your idea.
Yeah. And at the same time, start developing all of these alternatives.
Right. It's going to be a multi-pronged solution.
Yep. Let's not make the perfect the enemy of the good. Let's do them both. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. Bernie, as always, thanks so much for being
with
us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good talking with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. Back with your calls right after this.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on any topic, anything you want to talk about, from robotic pigeons to Neville Chamberlain. And first, there are two topics that I just want to riff on a little bit, and you can pick up on it or not. I just, you know, want to be on the record, as it were. First of all, this whole issue of appeasement. There is a difference between appeasement and negotiation, and apparently it's a difference that George W. Bush is unaware of. His speech yesterday before the Knesset has been characterized in a whole lot of different ways. I was shocked to hear one talk show host say, "Oh, he's pandering to the Jewish community." What kind of anti-Semitic nonsense is that? I mean, you know, somebody else saying, "Well, you know, he's just saying that you can't have conversation." You know, none of these arguments make any sense, because the bottom line is that George Bush didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, that's what it comes right down to. Other than the obvious, A, demagoguery, B, the American congressman whose name escapes me, who was being quoted by Harry Truman when Truman said, "Diplomacy stops at the water's edge." In other words, politics stops at the water's edge. In other words, we don't go outside. And this was the Truman Doctrine. This became the Truman Doctrine that you don't go outside the United States to talk about domestic political issues. You don't use international politics to be the tail that wags the dog of American politics. But anyhow, just laying out, and this is where Kevin James, this bozo from Los Angeles who was on the Chris Matthews show yesterday, just, you know, tragically trashed himself, because he made the mistake of talking with somebody who actually knew history, Chris Matthews. I mean, who would have known, right? Apparently Kevin didn't know. I can tell you, you know, Chris Matthews is a very, very smart guy. and very well educated and you know, understands what's going on. And so here this guy comes on, and he doesn't understand, just like Bush didn't understand, just like Bush's speechwriters didn't understand, or if they did, they thought the American public didn't understand the difference between appeasement and negotiation. Appeasement is when you go to somebody on the other side, shall we say, when you go to the other somebody on the other side and you say, we'll give you something if you'll give us something, and we're not even going to ask you to stop the really nasty stuff that you're doing. For example, Muammar Gaddafi. If you speak out against Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, you will be put to death. Muammar Gaddafi is running an absolute police state in Libya. For all the wonderful talk about democracy and all this kind of stuff that Bush engages in, Muammar Gaddafi would be the last guy in the world that he would want to appease. Muammar Gaddafi apparently personally, and if not personally, certainly the top guys in the security service, blew up Pan Am 106, or 103 rather, and brought down that plane over Lockerbie, Scotland all those years ago. Muammar Gaddafi, a bad guy, but he's got a bunch of oil. And so saying to the world, you know, we've decided Muammar Gaddafi is not an evil man. He's not a bad guy. He's not a terrorist. He's not supporting terrorists. And so we're going to ignore everything that he does. And we're going to let him keep doing it as long as he'll sell us oil. That is appeasement. And that is something, by the way, that George W. Bush did. In 1933, back in 38, in March of 38 was the Anschluss. This was when Austria was annexed by Nazi Germany. Hitler, you know, rode his tanks into Austria, went to the National Museum, took the Spear of Destiny. That's a whole other rant. And basically said, Austria is a historic part of Germany. We share a common language. We are the same people. And that was the Anschluss, the merging. And there was this great German nationalistic, oh, yeah, wonderful. You know, it's kind of cool, isn't it? The Germans, by and large, liked that. And then a year went by and things got kind of creepy for Hitler. And Hitler, there was a fairly strong movement. Not a public one, but a fairly strong movement of dissatisfaction with Hitler throughout the rest of 38. And so Hitler started saying, you know, now that we've got Austria, or not now that we, now that we've liberated Austria, now that it's part of Germany, there's another part of Europe that used to be part of Germany. We need to liberate that. That's the Sudetenland. The Austrian-German border with Czechoslovakia. And in August of 38, Chamberlain sent Lord Runciman to Czechoslovakia to try to work something out there. And the 15th of September, Chamberlain met with Hitler. On the 18th of September, the French Prime Minister, this was Edouard Daladier, I believe it's pronounced, went to Czechoslovakia and said, "No, we're not going to give Czechoslovakia to Hitler." Chamberlain then met Hitler on September 22nd, you know, a couple weeks later, and a week after that, Mussolini put together this thing, the Munich Agreement, September 29, 1938, and Chamberlain signed on to it. Chamberlain was Prime Minister of England, signed on to this thing that gave Germany the Sudetenland, part of Austria. And it was then officially and finally occupied the 1st through the 10th of October 1938, and finally through March of 39. Now, that was appeasement. And Neville Chamberlain, who had been the Chancellor of the Exchequer previously, he had been one of the people who helped put together the Treaty of Versailles. He had been one of the guys who helped create the economic disaster in Germany through the punishing payback stuff with the Treaty of Versailles. He was one of the guys who, he was not particularly popular, and as prime minister, he was feeling the heat for this. And so I suppose, you know, in retrospect, if you want to play psychobabble, you could say, you know, Chamberlain was trying to undo the damage that he did with the Treaty of Versailles, or at least his portion of it, as Chancellor of the Exchequer. He became prime minister in 37. But the bottom line is that is appeasement. Negotiation, on the other hand, is a completely different thing. Negotiation is what the Bush administration is doing right now with North Korea. Negotiation is, I mean, there's just a long history of negotiating with your enemies. Negotiation, talking to your enemies, this is what Ronald Reagan did with Gorbachev. It's what Jack Kennedy did with Khrushchev. There is an unending stream of history of talking to our enemies. That is not appeasement. So I think we just need to, you know, get it that either Bush doesn't know what he's talking about, or he's assuming that the American people are incredibly stupid and they don't understand the distinction between negotiation and appeasement. Because there is no Democrat that I know of who is suggesting appeasement of terrorists. Oh yeah, you know, let's give them whatever they want. Let's pay ransoms. You know, et cetera. That's appeasement. But no. Negotiating with somebody, talking with somebody, hearing what they have to say, offering them alternatives, trying to work things out, that is not appeasement. That is negotiation. That is statecraft. Statecraft, something that George Bush does not understand. The other thing that I wanted to bring up real quickly, and then we'll just take your calls here for the rest of the day. The other thing I wanted to bring up real quickly was this whole issue of who should be the vice president if Barack Obama is the nominee. Who should be the vice president? I think that if he were to select Hillary Clinton, on the one hand, her negatives are second to George Bush in terms of negative ratings among politicians. But I think that that could be healed and fixed. And this would be an enormously healing thing for Hillary Clinton to be on the ticket with. And I know a lot of Obama supporters are just hysterical about this. Oh, my God, you can't have that. I'm inclined to think that it might be a good idea. On the other hand, there are also a number of very, very good candidates out there. John Edwards, obviously, one of them. Joe Biden won. Bill Richardson won. There's a number of excellent people who would make vice presidential candidates for Barack Obama. Or, for that matter, if Hillary Clinton gets the nomination. Who should her, you know, should Obama be her vice presidential nominee? Would that be healing? I think that would be as well. So we can talk about that. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters. Teamsters for change, because it's time for a change in Washington, D.C. Teamster, singular, teamster.org, the website. Barb in Duluth, Minnesota. Hey, Barb, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling about the U.S. Senate race in Minnesota. You know, we all love Al Franken there. He's, you know, we listened to him on Air America for years, and he's one of our local guys, being from Minnesota and all, but a lot of us here, and I'm up north in Duluth, but a lot of us are supporting their...
Barb, you're vanishing. Your cell phone croaked right in the middle of that. I'm curious to find out what you're supporting, but in any case, Barb, I'm sorry we've lost you. Jeff in Denver, Colorado, KKZN. Hey, Jeff.
I'd like to make 3 points about energy. One, you know, we need to be very careful when we choose new energy sources, such as the one we've learned from ethanol.
Yeah.
And when Bernie keeps talking about the concentrated solar, I have a lot of objections to that, actually, in that we're using new virgin land in the desert. We have to build power lines that go hundreds of miles.
I'd much rather see decentralized solar.
Yeah, and also, you know, some of them actually require water, depending on how they're designed. But we have urban power. We have parking lots all over the country. Like in Arizona, they think of shading parking lots with solar panels.
Yep.
And in the north, you protect the cars, the parking lots from snow and so forth. You don't need to plow them if you put solar panels. We have more land available through parking lots than almost any other way. We can put
And the roofs of buildings, particularly commercial buildings.
We can put wind turbines way on the top of skyscrapers. Because way up there, the wind is much higher. But And there, we already have it within the grid.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't need to build new power lines. Also, like even when we're thinking about hydrogen, a lot of people don't realize if you don't make the hydrogen from the right source, if it doesn't release oxygen when you're getting the hydrogen, the burning of the hydrogen later can actually take oxygen from the atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one is hemp. Right there, hemp can be used for food, fuel, and clothing. It uses less water, less fertilizer. It could replace cotton, corn, and even some cases wood, and has much more biomass per acre per month as it grows really fast, tall, dense, and it's essentially a weed.
Mm-hmm.
And so We have all these simple things. We don't need to go to these really elaborate things in many cases. We can use what we already got. Parking lots.
I by and large agree with you, Jeff. And the elaborate things, of course, are promoted by the same big corporations that want to build nuclear power plants or want to build oil-fired plants, and they're the ones who have the ears of Washington.
And keep paying a monthly bill.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We need to decentralize our power to the point where every community, however you define community, whether it's a city block or whether it's a neighborhood or whether it's a small town, is energy independent. That needs to be our goal.
And decentralization promotes national security. If we built a pipeline to Anwar, if we drilled up there, all it would take is one person to blow up the pipeline, and we've lost that energy.
Yeah, it wouldn't even take one person blowing it up. It would take one good-sized truck smashing it.
Well, the Alaska pipeline, the one they have right now, one person with a rifle closed it down.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like it takes sophisticated technology to bring down these highly centralized systems. And the same thing with long line power lines. You know, take out one good power terminal, one tower that's holding up those lines, and boom, the whole thing goes down. Yeah. Spot on, Jeff. Thank you very much. Well said. Phil in Los Angeles, you want to disagree with me about George Bush's point? What am I missing?
I'm not disagreeing with you, Tom. I just think that Bush has an actual point here that I think is going to resonate with a lot of people tend to think that liberals that they misunderstand the threat of terrorists and the threat of dangerous regimes. And the point is that he's not saying that Barack Obama is going to make some sort of appeasement with them. He's saying that he's going to trust them. He's going to trust what they say, as Chamberlain trusted that Hitler wouldn't invade. And I think that a lot of people out there in the independent grouping and definitely in the conservative groups, they tend to believe that in their heart, that liberals, they just don't take it seriously enough, and that from a national security standpoint, that Bush is right about this, that you have to view these people as just crazy nuts that cannot be reasoned with and cannot and should not even be talked to, because nothing they say is of any value, and they're going to go back on it, and they're going to attack us, invade us.
Well, and certainly in some cases, Phil, there's truth to that. And there have been, times, certainly in the Middle East, where the truth of that has been demonstrated. On the other hand, history is replete with examples of times when negotiating with people, working things out, and then, as Ronald Reagan famously said, trust but verify. And then mechanisms are put into place that immediately come into place if these things don't work out, are there. And I think that's the really important part of it that gets missed. It's not about, hey, we're going to give you what you want, and then we're just going to sit back and ignore what you're doing. That's not how it works. And I don't think that Barack Obama, I don't think Hillary Clinton, I don't think, frankly, the Democratic Party are that stupid, that naive.
No, of course they're not, but I agree with you. But I think that's what the discussion needs to be from the Democratic side.
Yeah, I mean, Neville Chamberlain was a singular disaster, and he was perceived as a disaster by his own people. Winston Churchill took him apart. And it, But you're right, I think, Phil, that Bush's words probably will resonate and probably have resonated with a lot of people. And that's why it's so important to push back. And, in fact, I'll share with you some thoughts from no friend of the left, Pat Buchanan, on that right after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Sitting on the witness stand, the man with the book says, "Raise your hand. Repeat after me, I solemnly swear." The man looked down at his long hair, and although the young man solemnly swore, nobody seemed to hear anymore. And it didn't really matter if the truth was there. It was the cut of his clothes and the length of his hair, and the lonely voice of youth cries, "What is truth?"
Well, truth is something you're not going to get a great deal of from the Bush administration. Pat Buchanan last night talking about George Bush's appeaser comment and talking, as I mentioned earlier, about Bush's negotiations with Libya. Here's Pat Buchanan, no friend to the left.
It is astonishing the President of the United States would launch an attack on a presidential candidate from a podium in a foreign country. And the character of the attack is astounding. He's comparing Barack Obama to Neville Chamberlain appeasing Adolf Hitler and talking about going into Poland. And what makes it particularly astonishing is George Bush himself negotiated with Gaddafi's Libya in order to get them to give up their nuclear program, and Gaddafi was behind Pan Am 103. Will McCain endorse this statement about Barack Obama that, in effect, he is an appeaser?
Yeah, and my understanding is McCain has already said something to that effect. Here's the thing that set another piece of the response. This is Chris Matthews talking to Kevin James. Apparently he's on some little station in Los Angeles. Here's Chris Matthews.
Let me ask you, what did Chamberlain do wrong, Neville Chamberlain do wrong in 1939? What did he do wrong?
It all goes back to appeasement.
No, what did he do? Tell me what he did.
It's the key term.
You have to answer this question. What did he do?
It's the same thing. It puts it all.
Well, tell me what he did.
About appeasement.
What did Chamberlain do wrong?
His actions enabled, energized, legitimized. It's the exact same.
I'm not going to continue with this interview unless you answer what that thing is. What did Chamberlain do in 39? Tell me.
Chris, it's the exact
clueless.
Same thing.
What did he do?
What, 38, 39, Chris? What year
what
do you
did he
want?
Do?
It's the exact same thing that happened, Chris.
What did Chamberlain...
He's talking about appeasement.
All right. What did Chamberlain do? Just tell me what he did, Kevin. What did Chamberlain do you didn't like?
Look.
What did he do?
What the president was talking about Barack. Look, the
I want you to tell me, Mister. You're making a reference to the days before our involvement in World War II, when the war in Europe began. I want you to tell me
expert,
what did Chamberlain do wrong?
Look, you're not going to box me in here, Chris. President Bush was making that. Neville Chamberlain, he was an appeaser, Chris.
Yeah, he was an appeaser. What he did is he gave Hitler the Sudetenland. He gave Hitler part of Czechoslovakia. He thought that would satisfy him. And it was, I mean, any idiot could have seen what Hitler had done in Austria, what he had done in Czechoslovakia, the rhetoric that he was ramping up against Poland. Anyway, Mark in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Well, you say any idiot could see that, but it wasn't so clear back then.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't so clear to Chamberlain, but I'm telling you, there were a lot of voices in the British Parliament who were strongly opposed to Chamberlain and who were strongly opposed to him signing that. Chamberlain was very much like George W. Bush in that he surrounded himself with yes men and he refused to listen to Parliament.
Tom, I would say that Winston Churchill was in the minority, not Neville Chamberlain. But the point I want to make is that I don't think sometimes you know whether it's appeasement or negotiation until in hindsight, after the fact. And, you know, if maybe Hitler had stopped in Sudetenland, we'd be looking at Neville Chamberlain as the model for diplomacy. And I think you had mentioned that Bush, that it was diplomacy to deal with North Korea. I'd take the opposite side. I'd say that's appeasement. Here, you know, there's an old saying, Tom, you don't make a good deal with a bad man. Here's some people that have already cheated on the agreement they had with the Clinton administration. And so you go back and you renegotiate the same agreement.
Actually, the agreement that Kim Jong-il, not any good guy in my book, the agreement that he had with the Clinton administration was that there would be not just that he would stop his military program, his nuclear program, increasing the purity of the uranium beyond the 3.5% necessary for power. Not just that he would do that, but that he would put cameras, actual, live, real-time cameras in all the strategic locations so that the entire world, basically the IAEA in New York City, could monitor what was going on. When Bush called him the axis of evil, and when one of the members of the Bush administration, I forget which one it was, referred to him as a little something or other, you know, I forget the exact phrase, he pulled the cameras out. I mean, you know, so he didn't go back on the agreement with the Clinton administration. That was intact. It was Bush who blew up that agreement. It was Bush who blew that thing up. But your point, Mark, I think is really well made. At what point does diplomacy become appeasement? At what point does appeasement become diplomacy? Very often you don't know until you look in hindsight. But I guess then by Bush's definition, you never do either. You never negotiate for fear of ending up being an appeaser. So what do you have? You have a world at war. You have no possibility of international relationships whatsoever. That's nuts. That's absolutely nuts. Dan in Gaylord, Michigan. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to mention a couple of things about hemp and just pique my interest last hour.
Mm-hmm.
Hemp and marijuana are grown completely different methods.
It depends. I mean, they're both weeds. They can both just grow by any roadside.
Right, but I'm saying for production of marijuana, it's a specific sort of production method where the plants are far apart. You weed out all the male plants so it doesn't produce seed.
You sound like an expert on this, Dan.
No comment. when you grow hemp, you leave the males and the female plants together,
right,
and then they do go to seed. Now, if you want to grow hemp for biomass, you plant it very close together so you get a lot of stalks,
a very dense field of it, basically.
Right, exactly. And the DEA knows this. And when you plant hemp around marijuana crops, it destroys the marijuana crop because there's males in the hemp crop. They pollinate
so the THC level of the pot, it would hybridize, and the THC level of the marijuana plants would start dropping like crazy.
Right. Well, it also ruins the pot crop because then more of the plant's energy is diverted to making a seed rather than producing large amounts of THC,
right,
the active ingredient in marijuana.
Right.
Nine-delta-tetrahydrocannabinol. Right. So that would essentially destroy the marijuana crop as it is growing or significantly reduce its value.
Yeah.
And the DEA knows that, but they will not fight fire with fire by planting hemp crops where all the marijuana is grown to destroy the marijuana crop. So,
well, a lot of the marijuana is grown in little patches in national forests and little out of the way places and things like that. But your point is that growing hemp would not diminish the ability of the DEA to find that stuff. What possible argument can they put forward now other than just the jingoistic, you know, reefer madness, be afraid? Let's assume that the average American person doesn't know these things and doesn't know that. I mean, what's their rationale? I don't get it. You know, it's legal in Canada.
Right. Well, there is really no legal rationale other than the fact that, in my opinion, that it's a direct competitor with petroleum products because it has a large amount of carbohydrates, which are very similar to the hydrocarbons that we use in petroleum products.
I wonder to what extent it may be a direct competitor with the cotton industry, because keep in mind, back in the 20s, it was the cotton industry that was funding in large part the reefer madness stuff. because they saw hemp as a competition to cotton for high-quality paper, for bond paper, and also for clothing.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was banned in 1937, essentially banned, by the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act.
Right.
And was backed up by Harry Anslinger and William Randolph Hearst. He promoted it and actually used marijuana to demonize Mexicans during the Mexican-American War.
Right. Yeah.
So it was amazing. It goes back a long way, and hemp hasn't been grown here for a lot of different reasons, but it's essentially economic.
Although we should keep in mind George Washington grew hemp, our first president. Dan, thanks for the injection of sanity into the conversation. I appreciate it, and thank you for informing me. I didn't know that if hemp is grown near pot, it destroys the pot crop. So we all learned I learned something today. Thank you. Barb in Duluth, Minnesota. Hey, Barb.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I thought I'd try again. I'm calling from northern Minnesota in Duluth, of course, and we all love Al Franken there. He's one of our guys and from Minnesota, and you listen to him for years on Air America. But there are a lot of us in Minnesota who are supporting, you know, there is one other Democratic candidate in the race, and we in Minnesota call it, the DFL endorsement rather than just Democratic. As
right.
You know, it's a Democratic
Farm Labor Party. Yeah.
Right.
I thought the other Democrat was the former mayor. I thought he had dropped out.
No, there were four candidates. Two have dropped out. There is another candidate named Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and he is actually, much stronger than Al Franken on ending the Iraq War. He opposed it from the beginning. He's also much stronger than Al Franken on universal single-payer health care.
How is he polling? Because the big issue, Barb, ultimately isn't, again, making the good the enemy, the perfect the enemy of the good. The big issue isn't who's the best guy in this race. The big issue is who's going to beat Norm Coleman.
I'll tell you that the delegates across the state are switching over to Jack in huge numbers. For one reason, because Jack Nelson Pallmeyer is an incredible debater. And I think that's what's going to be needed to go up against a man like Norm Coleman, who is, of course, a very polished candidate. And Jack, I got to wrap it up,
but thank you for the information. Interesting. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
George W. Bush, and I approve this song. I could kill a couple minutes just talking to lieutenants about Saddam Hussein. I could grasp what they were saying and the dangerous game we're playing if I only had a brain. With my thoughts unconstipated, I'd be intellectualated and thinking without pain. Each executive decision would be based on more than wishing if I only had a brain.
If only. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's a short clip of John McCain talking about working with Hamas. Is this appeasement?
Do you think American diplomats should be operating the way they have in the past in working with the Palestinian government if Hamas is now in charge?
They're the government, and sooner or later we're going to have to deal with them in one way or another. And I understand why this administration and previous administrations had such antipathy towards Hamas is because of their dedication to violence and the things they not only espouse but practice. But it's a new reality in the Middle East. And I think the lesson is people want security and a decent life and a decent future. Then they want democracy. Fatah was not giving them that.
Interesting. Chris in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. It's really funny hearing him talk about the solution for Hamas, which is basically people starving in Gaza.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have the perfect
triangulation. Well, and to some extent, let's just acknowledge that Hamas brought that on themselves.
I ain't going to go there.
Yeah, well, I have been saying for a long, long time that if Hamas wanted to really get their point across, that they should be following Gandhi's advice, and then they would have the world on their side. Instead, you know, sending off suicide bombers, blowing off rockets and things like that, it just, you know.
And winning elections doesn't help either, does it?
Well, see, that's the thing. I mean, you know, they're winning elections because they're providing people with food and hospitals and schools and things like that. We should be doing that. Israel should be doing that. The rest of the world should be in there helping out that region.
No, there should be a one-state solution for Palestine and Israel.
But you mean, a two-state solution?
No, one-state solution.
Okay.
No, living together equally. Palestinians and Israelis.
In one country.
Yes, why not?
Yeah, because it ain't going to happen.
Well,
it ain't going to happen. I've spent a lot of time in that part of the world. I can tell you there's a lot of antipathy and there's a lot of history there. It ain't going to happen, but...
Well, we're going off topic, though.
Yeah,
I wanted to talk about those.
You wanted to talk about VPs.
Yeah, the triangulation dream team for me is basically John McCain and the guy from Connecticut, Lieberman,
mm-hmm.
and Obama and Colin Powell.
So John McCain, the Republican, picks Joe Lieberman, the former Democrat, and
they were set,
Barack Obama, the Democrat, picks yeah. Colin Powell, the former Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that would be an interesting ticket, wouldn't it? You know, there's a lot of talk in that realm about Chuck Hagel as a guy who would be a running mate for Obama. I think probably the biggest negative is that he used to be the president of the of what became ES&S, the voting machine company, although I don't think that most people know about that. But that's the kind of thing that could come back to haunt Chuck Hagel. But Chuck Hagel has done a pretty remarkable job of being a renegade. He's the true, I mean, you know, McCain is portrayed as the independent, the renegade within the Republican Party. I'd say the true one is Chuck Hagel. But interesting thought, Chris. Thanks for sharing it. Very interesting. Get your thoughts on who should be the running mate for Barack Obama if he's the nominee, or for that matter for Hillary Clinton if she's the nominee. Or, for that matter, John McCain. Who should he pick? Who will he pick? Interesting. Brian in Florida listening on WINS. Hey, Brian.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, I just want to say, first off, I really appreciate you promoting the idea of a joint ticket between Obama and Hillary. I think that's really awesome.
I'm not sure it's the optimal thing, but I can build an argument against it, but I can also build a very strong argument for it. And I think that a lot of the ideologues on both sides who have taken these very, very rigidified positions would suddenly find themselves in a position where they would have to soften. They would have to say, okay, maybe the other one isn't quite as evil as I thought.
Ah, sounds like uniting the party to me.
Yeah, exactly. What a novel concept.
Let's see. This is kind of like a shout-out Friday, right?
There you go, yeah. Whatever you'd like. It's we call it Anything Goes Friday here.
I like it. Gay marriage in California, awesome. I think they're finally leading the nation, and it's about time.
Yeah, I agree. Well said, and you wanted to add something to that?
Oh, I got a couple of things. I'll be quick, though. Al Franken, I heard about his campaign, and the Republicans were criticizing him about the whole tax thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem is they don't realize he paid those taxes in New York.
Right. So he paid them. He ended up paying those taxes twice. Yeah. And just to, you know, to keep it looking good, and that really harmed him. And I think it's a real shame. It's so tough, particularly when you're on your own. You know, when you're an independent contractor, you're out doing gigs on your own, to keep track of who pays you when and how and all that. But he relied on his bookkeeper, and that was a mistake. I can tell you, I made that mistake once back years ago. Jerry and I had a business in New York. This must have been 20 years ago. And our bookkeeper forgot. He gave us a copy. He forgot to mail it. The withholding to the state of New York, and they hit us with like this $30,000 fine 2 years later, and we were like, what? What's this? Just sometimes that kind of stuff happens. Anyhow, Bill in Lacombe, Oregon. Hey, Bill, we got about a minute here before the break. What's up?
Well, basically what I was thinking about was the aggregate profit from a barrel of oil. We know that they don't just get gasoline and diesel out of oil.
No, they get lipstick and drugs and fertilizer.
Drugs,
and
agrochemicals.
There are some people who suggest that a barrel of oil can produce as much as $10,000 worth of product.
Yeah, and basically that's what I'm looking at. Is when you put that together with what the lady was talking about earlier about making a set price for gasoline.
Yeah.
You know, they've got profit coming off of this that's not reliant on gas.
Yeah, in fact, there's a book out there that I don't recall the title of it, but we had the author on this program, must have been about 2 months ago, who suggested that gasoline is a byproduct. It's a waste product. It's like the leftover stuff. It's the stuff nobody wants, and it's the least profitable part of the barrel of oil. We'll be picking up your calls right after.
The Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. Our telephone number here on Anything Goes Friday. TomHartman.com for our blog and our message board. AirAmerica.com for all things Air America. John in Los Angeles, California. Hey, John, listening on K-Talk. What's up?
Hello, Tom. I would just like to say to everybody who's aghast at George Bush saying what he said about appeasement and over there instead of over here when it was domestic politics and this whole Truman Doctrine thing, it's all a bunch of naivety to think that it has any connection with reality when you consider about how corporations, big commerce, it virtually control this country through lobbying, and how they basically controlled it with Eisenhower's industrial complex, and they also controlled it way back when they were George W.'s grandpappy's bank was appeasing Hitler during his run-up.
Yeah, well, and you know, we had colonies in the 19th century in Central America, but yeah. By the way, the Truman Doctrine itself. Let us just clarify terms here. The Truman Doctrine itself was a doctrine that Harry Truman made after the president of Greece, as I recall, might have been Turkey, but I think it was Greece, visited the United States, and basically, the essence of the Truman Doctrine, and this was in 1947, was that we were going to support both Greece and Turkey. We were going to give them economic support. We were going to give them military support. We were going to help them out. And it was really part of the Cold War. It was an effort to keep them from falling into the sphere of the Soviets, as eventually at least the perception was that Egypt had and other countries. And that was the Truman Doctrine. And Harry Truman did that with the Republican-controlled Congress. Truman's statement that domestic policy ends at the water is not the Truman Doctrine, but it's a good one. It's a good one. But your point is well made, John, and I appreciate it. Steve in Monterey, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Steve.
I know you like Kennedy quotes, so let me start with, let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
Amen. And a great speech. He said that on several occasions, one of them at Michigan State University in 1962.
And I believe it was in the inaugural address as well.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, if I was president of Iran, I wouldn't talk to crazy nut liars like Bush and his minions. if there's any appeasers around, it's Spain, Italy, Bulgaria at all, that invested support troops in the coalition of the coerced for fear of losing American foreign aid.
Yeah, well, you know, good point, Steve. And there's probably folks, and this is, it's interesting to watch Iranian politics. There are probably a lot of folks in Iran who are going, you're going to talk to who? You know, or it's just, yeah, interesting. Craig in San Jose, California, listening on Green 960.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to put my two cents in on the gas tax and say that I really like Senator Sanders, but I have to disagree with him on this one, and I tend to agree with your position from last week. I think if you're going to try to help our fellow Americans, you know, who are struggling and suffering, you can compensate them in other areas of their life, like mortgage relief or a middle-class tax cut or health care, something like that. But the wrong thing.
What do you do for the guy who's got to drive, who lives in a rural area and has to drive 30 miles round trip 30 miles each way to work, 60 miles round trip every day.
Well, again, if you help them out in other areas of their life to compensate for the high fuel prices, then you've accomplished what you were trying to do without encouraging Americans to continue using the fuels that we're trying to get us to use less of.
Well, and the other argument against it, and I think we just have to just lay this out here. The other argument against it is the one that Barack Obama made, which is that six different states have tried this. Illinois was one of them, where they did away with the state tax for a while to reduce the cost of oil. And what did the oil companies do? They jacked up their prices equal to the amount that the tax had been reduced.
Yeah.
So I
agree with Bernie that we need to help these folks, but I don't think you help them, you know, by encouraging people to still use these fuels. You help them by giving them compensation in other areas of their life to help make up for the.
His point is something needs to be done immediately. That we can't say, oh, yeah, you know, in 10 years we'll have windmills. That's not going to help the guy who can't feed his family.
I agree. Give him a middle-class tax cut.
Yeah. And Obama is talking about that, $1,000 middle-class tax cut, and I think it's an excellent suggestion. Craig, thank you very much. Well said. Ben in L.A. Hey, Ben.
Good morning, Tom. Why don't we follow the 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution for the first time since the 1820s? And let the electors choose the president and vice president the way our first six presidents were chosen. And then we can save the U.S. taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars on these phony elections and use the money to give health care to all the American people.
Well, the electors do select the president. What the 12th Amendment does is it specifies that each state shall determine how their electors are going to be sent to Washington, D.C. to cast the votes for the president.
Our two parties don't follow the 12th Amendment. They make their own.
They make their own rule.
And one other thing,
sure they do. The states decide, in the political apparatus of the states. I agree with you that the two party system is flawed in the United States, and my opinion is that the way to fix it is with instant runoff voting, which will allow there to be multiple parties. But the states are sending their electors. You know, this is why Tom Feeney, when he was Speaker of the House of Representatives in Florida in 2000, why he stood up and he said, even if the recount, which was ordered by the Supreme Court of the state of Florida, of every single vote in Florida, even if that recount shows that Al Gore won more votes in Florida, that he, as the head of the majority in the House of Representatives in Florida, and he legally had the right and authority to do this under the 12th Amendment of the Constitution, he was going to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., anyway. Fact of the matter is, any state can send anybody they want.
According to the U.S. Constitution, the state legislatures are supposed to choose the electors from
that's
the
right.
state.
That's right. That's right.
But they don't do it. They certainly do it.
They do it by passing laws which say that the political parties have their nominating processes and they select the electors. And in those cases where there's not a political party who selects an elector, for example, Ross Perot or a third party or independents, those electors can be selected as well and sent from the states. It's all there.
Well, I'd like to one other in closing. If the corporate stooges who run both our major parties and our universities would offer the Iraqi people profit sharing on their oil reserves, we could probably get 4 or 5 million barrels of oil a day out of Iraq within a few months. But evidently, our corporate stooges, particularly from the universities, they want to give all the Iraq's oil reserves to make our major corporations richer. And that's why they won't give the people in Iraq profit sharing.
Yeah, well,
thanks for your time, Tom.
You're welcome. Yeah, the people of Iraq have, I think, $87 billion right now in U.S. banks as a result of the sale of their oil. Here's an interesting one. Why is it that oil is being drilled on U.S. federal lands and the oil companies are paying $5, $10, $15, $20 a barrel for it, and they're selling it for $120 a barrel to us to put into our strategic petroleum reserve? That makes no sense. Bill in Tennessee. Hey, Bill, what's up?
I noticed everybody was taking off on Chamberlain pretty good since George Bush's comments. And I don't know if people realize it, but the German secret code was already broke when Chamberlain went to sign his peace agreements. And the peace agreements were nothing more than a stalling tactic. As soon as he got back, Great Britain very quietly went into full-time war production. They had about a half a dozen Spitfires when he returned, and they built a brand new factory and went 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, building Spitfires.
You're right. They did start preparing for war as soon as he came back. You're absolutely right. But
Chamberlain is not the dummy everybody portrays him.
What he said to the British people and to the world was, you know, that we have peace for our time, and so your point is that you know what should Chamberlain have done differently in your mind, or do you think that he did the exact right thing?
I don't think he needed to do anything. I think he was just stalling for time while Great Britain built up their war machine.
Do you think if he called out Hitler on what Hitler was doing, that would have provoked an immediate war and Britain wouldn't have been ready for it?
Great Britain was just stalling for time. They did not have a first-class fighter aircraft, and they didn't feel that their navy was capable of handling their empire during war. Mm-hmm. So they immediately, as soon as Chamberlain came back, they immediately built Spitfires and Hawker Hurricanes by the hundreds and converted merchant ships over to
military use,
destroyers and cruisers. And I believe they had the German secret code broke before then. So each move, even when Hitler invaded France, the British knew beforehand. And history has kind of avoided telling the truth about that whole little operation.
That's interesting. Redefining appeasement and rehabilitating Neville Chamberlain. Bill, thanks for the call from Tennessee. I suspect a lot of us are going to be out doing a little Googling, doing a little reading here this afternoon. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio. Anything goes Friday. 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes Friday. And John in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, John, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I'd like to talk about a model of encountering the other, the one who isn't like me and my group, that maybe gets us past the language, is this appeasement or is this negotiation?
Mm-hmm.
And it's simply calling it peacemaking. And it's a model demonstrated by Francis of Assisi when he encountered the Sultan during the height of the Crusades. And first of all, Francis had no illusions whatsoever of the risk. He knew that there was a very good possibility that he might not come back to Assisi, that he could be killed. And so integral to peacemaking is the courage to take a risk.
This is not dissimilar. I mean, No. The scale is probably much larger, but it's not all that dissimilar to the marchers on Selma, to some of the places where Martin Luther King found himself.
Oh, absolutely, Gandhi,
Jesus. I mean, Saint Francis was. I mean, obviously, he preceded the more recent ones. And in fact, The Little Flowers of St. Francis is just a marvelous collection of stories about him that I recommend to anybody who is, interested in him and his life.
And another thing that Francis did when he first met with the Sultan was simply to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And in the listening came to realize that he wasn't the three-headed monster Antichrist that he was made out to be.
Yeah.
And then when Francis spoke with the Sultan, the first thing he did was repent of the Crusades and told the Sultan that the slaughter of Muslim families has absolutely nothing to do with the gospel of Jesus. In fact, it makes a mockery of that gospel.
In fact, I would submit to you, John, that even before he listened and even before he tried to make things right that had been wrong, that he acknowledged the other as a fellow human being. And the objectification of the other is at the core of so much of this. And the kind of rhetoric that George Bush is putting out just feeds that. And it is so destructive. Thanks so much for the call. Matt in Honolulu, Hawaii. Hey, Matt.
Hi. I'm going to do this real quick and then take your response off the air.
Okay.
I'm very, very happy at the decision made by the California Supreme Court yesterday. But I feel that there's going to be a blowback from the right.
Of course.
And I think that if they want 1.3 million signatures to say, oh, the voters feel this is so terrible, well, then maybe we should get 1.5 million saying, no, this is right and this is constitutional. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, Matt, that is an option, actually, to start a movement across California to put into the Constitution. Because, see, the Supreme Court said that this ban is unconstitutional, that our Constitution does not allow for bigotry, basically. And so what the right-wing guys, you know, what the right-wing homophobes in California are trying to do is say, no, our Constitution does allow for bigotry. In fact, we're going to write it into the Constitution. We're going to explicitly put bigotry in the Constitution. And if they do, then the Supreme Court won't be able to say, well, the Constitution isn't isn't bigoted anymore. So why not have a movement to put into the Constitution explicit language that says that when this Constitution speaks of, you know, when there's a part of the Constitution that speaks against bigotry, it includes the ability of gays to be married. I mean, just put it in specifically. All that said, my guess is that, you know, 1.3 million signatures, all this kind of stuff, you know, that they probably will get the signatures, they probably will get it on the ballot, and they're going to use it to try and drive up the Republican vote. I've seen this over and over and over again. I've been watching this in Vermont for years, for example. We have an initiative process in Oregon as well. And in those states where it's possible for private individuals to put things on the ballot, you get all this out-of-state money, mostly from right-wing causes, to put these right-wing things on the ballot. And it's not even because they want them to win. It's because they want to draw the right-wingers out of their homes and into the ballot place so that they'll vote against those gays or against, you know, in favor of three strikes and you're out or whatever it may, you know, some crazy thing. They will vote for that out of fear. And then they'll say, oh, while I'm here, I guess I might as well vote for the Republican. Fred in Northville, Michigan. Hey, Fred, you got about a minute here before the bottom of the hour break. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Basically, I wanted to talk about briefly a candidate that I think would be someone that for the Democratic side, and I know he's a Clinton supporter at this point, but Joe Sestak. I'm sure it's someone that you're familiar with. But
tell our listeners.
Pardon me?
Tell our listeners who Joe is.
Joe Sestak is a representative from Pennsylvania who is a retired three-star admiral. He is the highest-ranking military man ever in the United States Congress. When he retired, at one point at the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, he was in charge of an aircraft battle carrier group, which included an aircraft carrier as well as 30 other support ships. He was the director of the defense policy of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, and shortly after 9/11 was involved in anti-terrorism functions. He's got an MBA from, or an MPA and a PhD in political economy and government from Harvard. And I think that those would go very well because, number one, we're looking at, with his speech yesterday, obviously, security is going to be an issue.
Yeah, he's a military guy. He's from Pennsylvania. I think, yeah, a lot of upsides there. There are a lot of upsides. There are actually many military men. You'll recall one who ran in the last campaign. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-302-2270. Well, Congressman Tom Feeney, the Republican from Florida, who was the guy who, according to Clint Curtis, went to him and said, hey, can you write some vote-flipping software for me? And became Speaker of the House in Florida and was the guy who said that even if Al Gore won Florida, he was going to deliver Republican electors to Washington, D.C. Probably one of the most sick, twisted, and toxic politicians in all of America, Congressman Tom Feeney. And now he's in the House of Representatives from Florida. And he said that this decision to allow gay marriage in California by the Florida Supreme Court came from unelected judges who had irresponsibly decided to legislate from the bench. So, let's look. Yeah, well, it turns out in California they elect their judges. And the judges who voted on this, well, Justice Joyce Kennard was confirmed in 2006 with 74.5% of the vote. Justice Carol Corrigan, she got in 2006 74.4% of the vote. Justice Catherine Werdegar, confirmed in 2002 with 74.1% of the vote. Justice Carlos Moreno, confirmed in 2002 with 72.6% of the vote. Justice Marvin Baxter in 2002 with 71.5% of the vote. Justice Ronald George, confirmed in 98, with 75% of the vote. And Justice Ming William Chin, confirmed in 1998, with 68.3% of the vote. So here we've got the conservatives doing their gay trashing, gay baiting, and freaking out about the judges and the courts because things aren't going their way. When in fact, in California, the court is elected. And Tom Feeney, you should go back to stealing elections. 1-866-303-2270. Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Lou, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
I'm fine. I have a theory about the hesitance of the Bush regime and John McWhorter to want to negotiate. You've heard the old joke about when you're doing something, you've got to be smarter than what you're dealing with.
Yeah.
And I feel in my own mind that they realize somewhere in their reptilian little minds that when their ancestors, the European ancestors, were crawling out of caves, the people in that part of the world, around Mesopotamia especially, were building ziggurats, animal husbandry, agriculture, you name it.
So he doesn't want to negotiate with the Persians, the Iranians, because he's afraid he'll be outmaneuvered.
Yeah. You don't. In a battle of wits, they would be completely overshot.
Yeah, I'm telling you, in a battle of wits, George W. Bush would be outdone by a golden retriever.
Yeah, you got it.
that's the problem. But Lou, your point is well taken. Thank you very much for making it. Ken in East Brunswick, New Jersey. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I called you a few weeks ago to express my concern that Cheney and his fellow warmongers would probably not be interested in giving up power on January 20th, election or no election, and one of the main clubs they use on us is the image of 9/11, and not only that, but there's a mythology that goes with that, and your response was something like we don't know enough about them. What really happened on 9/11, we need to, get the good, we need to have
it has not been really seriously researched.
I'm sorry?
In my opinion, 9/11, here it is 40 years after JFK was assassinated, and frankly, and I'm not blowing my own horn, NBC did an hour-long special on it that plays on the Discovery Channel about once a month. Lamar Waldron and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice that lays out exactly, I think, really what happened with the Kennedy assassination. It took 40 years. We don't know what happened on 9/11. I mean, we just don't.
This is the age of the internet. I think we can learn things a lot faster. But my point was really that we really could have some common ground because, I mean, the National Security Director said at the time nobody had any clue that airplanes would be flying into buildings. I mean, we know that's a damn lie. And what came out of that was the director. Director of National Security fired. All of a sudden they had to invent something called Homeland Security. Wasn't good enough to have national security.
Yeah. Let's point out, just for our listeners who are not familiar with what you're talking about, Condoleezza Rice held a news conference after 9/11 in an interview with a reporter in which she said, "We could never have imagined that terrorists would use an airplane, a passenger plane, as a missile," when in fact, 6 months before that, George Bush had been at the G7 meeting or whatever it was one of the big meetings in Europe, in I believe, as I recall, it was Italy, and they had to move him offshore and put him in an aircraft carrier offshore because there were credible stories that Al-Qaeda was planning on hijacking a passenger plane and flying it into the building that he was in.
There's a whole build-up mythology around people, sneaking into the country. And one of our own Jersey girls from my neighborhood, it took her to point out that the alleged hijackers didn't sneak into the country. They had visas that were, in many cases they were imperfect, but the imperfections were just simply overlooked. And to me, there's a whole bunch of hype and mythology that's built up around 9/11, and we can't afford to wait for congressional investigations to put out the frame that there's a myth, that we're being intimidated by a myth.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And if you really want to get the story on this, go to theyrule.net. Theyrule.net lays out how the boards of the largest corporations in America interact, and not that I think that any of them were behind 9/11, but why it's in their interest to essentially put all this behind us. Well, let's not talk about that, let's just move along. And yeah. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan, you want to correct me. The Little Flower was Saint Teresa. Am I misremembering my books?
Well, there's more to this story. It becomes ironic. Saint Teresa was called the Little Flower, mm-hmm. and in Royal Oak, Michigan, there was or still is a shrine of the Little Flower. And that's where the notorious Father Coughlin used to preach.
Oh, interesting. Who was the Rush Limbaugh of the 1930s?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Well, here's what I remember. Back in the 70s, I was very, very into this. And I read a book called The Little Flowers of St. Francis, which was a collection of stories that were, to the extent that it was possible, contemporaneous stories, stories that people had written when he was still alive about his life. And I'm sure it's still in print. And then there's also a book about St. Teresa that I read, St. Teresa of Avila, if that's who we're speaking of, the one who was the mentor to St. John of the Cross. In fact,
he was
tortured because of his association with her. She tried to reform the Carmelite order and move it away from the pomp and ceremony of the church. And the book about her is that she wrote is called Interior Castle, and it's about her metaphysical experiences, shall we say, or spiritual experiences.
Right.
And then the extraordinary book that I read these were all books that changed my life or changed the way I viewed the world and viewed spirituality. And the book about St. John was The Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross.
Exactly.
And those three books, if anybody wanted to have an insight into the real core of Catholic mysticism,
right,
I would say.
Contemplative.
And these were books that I was a big fan of Thomas Merton, and I read a number of his books, Little Flowers of Zen and others. Thomas Merton frequently referred to Interior Castle by Teresa of Avila and the various writings about both of the other, St. John of the Cross and the other, if you want to get Protestant, look at Meister Eckhart.
Meister, I had his book.
Oh yeah, but there's a number of brilliant collections of the sayings and the writings of Meister Eckhart. He didn't write at length, in generally speaking, but I think that he was a truly enlightened person. I think he was fully there, and Meister Eckhart was absolutely extraordinary. Bernice, I got to move along, but I appreciate your bringing it up. Thank you very much for the call. David in Blaine, Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. After his treasonous and embarrassing performance in Israel yesterday, Bush, in his own foolishness and delusion, was recently in Saudi Arabia with the propaganda being that he was trying to negotiate more oil production. But the issue is not...
Like he did the last time.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, because there's a pick on Democratic Underground, him laughing it up with Abdullah, making sandcastles.
Yeah,
and so the issue is not supply and demand, but a weak dollar, and the U.S. petroleum companies exploiting this by gouging all of us.
Yeah,
and the
weak dollar is the result of 30 years of insane Republican voodoo economics.
Insane, and now we have 60. And Saudi Arabia gets to enjoy 64 cents U.S. Per gallon of gasoline. Isn't that great?
Yeah. Yeah, it's great fun. Yeah, thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate the call. June in Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Oh, the guy just raised my hackles a little bit talking about Neville Chamberlain and what a genius he was.
Well, he didn't say he was a genius. He just said he was buying time, and I didn't hear any high praise of him, merely pragmatic. But you don't think that Chamberlain was being pragmatic at all? You think he just screwed up?
Well, they might have been pragmatic in knowing that by that time they needed to expand their arms, but they're the ones, the conservatives, let the time slip, you know, in the years before that, for one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. The history of Europe, after World War One, well, World War One itself, and what led up to it, but after World War One, the Treaty of Versailles, the rise of Nazism in Germany. I mean, in retrospect, it's so easy to see the horrible mistakes that were made. 45 minutes past.
Tom Hartman, speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A special thanks so much to the person who really makes this program as great as it is, Louise Hartman. And equal praise to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to the folks in New York who make it work, Chris Rose and Lauren Kirshner, Sean Kenzine and Marcus Hillman, especially Chris and Lauren at Air America New York, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room and all the work that Sue has done, our archives and everything else, and to keeping the message boards going, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Sean in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind today?
Hello there. I just wanted to expand on the extreme lack of imagination from the right wing in not being able to make the connection between people, planes, and buildings. Condoleezza Rice was mentioned earlier. I want to take people back about 10 and a half years to the fiction bestsellers list. It would have been one heck of a story if it were nonfiction. Tom Clancy, Debt of Honor. At the end of the book, a disgruntled Japanese gentleman decides to fly a hijacked plane into the U.S. Capitol building.
A kamikaze mission.
There we are, yep. And as I say, this was the best-selling fiction book for Christmas. So enough people must have read this book, must have...
is there anybody in America who's never heard of what the kamikaze pilots were?
Exactly.
I
dare say Tom Clancy obviously didn't just come up with the idea of Japanese people flying planes into things himself.
It was
World
nothing
War
new.
II, it's right there.
And the fact of the matter is that in the 1970s, in the late 60s and early 70s, when there were a rash of hijackings in the United States, people taking planes down to Cuba, and then there was also J.D. Cooper, or whatever his name was, B.D. Cooper, up in the Pacific Northwest, you know, with his, I think it was $250,000 or some amazing amount of money that he got. He parachuted out of the back of 727. Yeah. And, you know, basically all these hijackings, there was legislation before Congress to harden the cockpit doors so that planes could not be hijacked. You know, so nobody could, you know, kick in the door or walk through the door and put a gun to the head of the pilot and say, you will do thus and so.
Absolutely.
And the airline industry fought it because it would have cost them, you know, $5, $10, $20, $50, I don't know how much, $1,000 per, it would have cost them millions of dollars over their fleet. And,
oh, yeah, Ed, that looks like a pretty good investment now.
And all the other airlines in the world were doing it. And El Al had been doing it from day one. And El Al, I mean, you know, you talk about a country where you've got some people who might want to hijack your planes. El Al has never had a plane hijacked.
Yeah. Yeah, because they have great security.
They have great security, and they have hardened cockpit doors.
They don't confuse the rhetoric of trying to scare people with actually getting the job done.
There you go. Well said, Sean. Thank you very much. Rick in Seattle, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Rick.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I think one thing that a lot of people overlook in the history of leading up to World War II is that not only did Neville Chamberlain sign a treaty with Hitler, But Joseph Stalin, one of the worst dictators in history, signed a non-aggression pact with Hitler.
Yeah, and ended up getting bit in the butt by it. Yeah,
So no one would accuse him of being an appeaser.
Well, or being militarily stupid.
Right.
Yeah, for all his other flaws, I think Stalin was clinically paranoid. I think he was, mentally ill, clinically paranoid. But he certainly was no dummy when it came to military affairs. Rebecca in Woodland, Washington. Hey, Rebecca, what's up?
Yeah, looking forward to the Oregon primary coming up on Tuesday.
Yeah, it should be fascinating.
Don't hear much about it. But I just wanted to point out that headline, the paper, GOP vows changes after losing third seat in Congress, which is pretty good. But locally, if you look at all the little flyers you get from Congress people and stuff, the Republicans are not putting the Republicans on it anymore. You have to look down to the tiny reading where you see their website, and then it will have a tiny, tiny R.
Right. So it's funny. I forgive my laughing, but if you've listened to this program for more than a couple of years, you know that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, I've always had conservatives on and debated them. And 5, 6 years ago in particular, when they were really riding high, they'd come on and they'd introduce themselves as Republicans and as conservatives. Uh-huh. And now I get them on and I'll say, Joe Blow, a Republican and they'll say, no, I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. Or I'm not a Republican. I'm a libertarian, and
to read the fine print.
Yeah, they are running as fast from it as they can. Rebecca, thanks for the call. Joe in Sacramento, California. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Two of the topics that you guys been talking about, real quick, on the Neville Chamberlain thing. Let's not try to resurrect him too soon. Don't forget, Hitler wrote Mein Kampf 15 years before and laid out exactly what he was going to do. So
yeah, you're right. You're right. It shouldn't have been a surprise to anybody. You're absolutely right. June in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, June. We're just about out of time here, June.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. It's going to have to be real quick.
Okay, you have enough time. Well, this is about Hillary, and I can't forgive her for it. In her first page of her autobiography, she talked about servicemen coming home at the end of World War II, including her own father, resuming civilian lives. She said, the United States had saved the world from Nazi aggression. Now it was a shared victory. Little old England stood alone between May 10th, 1940, 2 days ago, and June 22nd, 1941, when they invaded Russia. All alone, it was the belief of the Groza administration that England was a bastion that had to stand.
Yeah, no, I get it, and I understand that you're not pleased with Hillary about that, June. Thank you for that, but what can I say? I still think that Hillary would make a great president and that Barack Obama would make a great president. We have a wealth of riches, an embarrassment of riches. What a great position to be in, frankly. We'll see you on Monday. I'm in Chicago today. I'll be signing books tonight, and I'll be at the Green Fest this weekend. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.